Is your car stored in the driveway overnight or on the road? Is your phone in a protective case? Does your house have an alarm? The insurers want to know that the thing they are going to insure for you is protected, that you're doing your best to look after it, to care for it. They want to make sure that they're dealing with a sensible person who is protecting and caring for the thing that they are going to insure against loss or damage. They'll work through a checklist to make sure that you're doing the best possible job to care for the thing that they are going to insure for you. They want to make sure that you're protecting your stuff. And in a security-conscious culture like ours, with PIN numbers and padlocks and all sorts of alarm systems and codes, the words of Jesus come counter to that. They hit us up the face like some really strange contradiction. It's understandable if these words of Jesus don't initially compute. He says, whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Doesn't seem to resonate with our security-conscious culture that Jesus talks about. The best way to get life, to possess life, is to lose it. And the surest possible way to lose your life, to be left lifeless, is to find it and to hold on to it, to cling to it with all your might. This contradiction hits us up the face and runs counter to everything our culture tells us about self-protection and care for our own stuff and our own lives. Jesus is speaking to his disciples and trying to prepare them for the road ahead, to get them ready for what it's going to be like to be a sent person, to be someone on mission with Jesus. He's laying down some foundations to help them know what this path is going to be like. He lays out the basics. He sets down some markers to say, here's how it's going to play out. This is what you can be sure of. This is how you know that you're on the right path. And he leads with a small print. He says, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Now, you don't need to know the food chain too intricately to work out that this is not going to play out well. If you are sent out as a sheep among wolves, it's not a very exciting prospect. In fact, it's a very daunting one. And so Jesus is alerting his disciples to the fact that this is going to be tough. It's going to be hard. Jesus is preparing his disciples for persecution. He's preparing them for the way ahead and saying, if you are a sent person, if you are following me, if you're on mission with me, then you've got to be prepared for persecution. You've got to be prepared for life to be difficult. Be on your guard. They'll hand you over to the local councils. They'll flog you in the synagogues. You'll be brought before governors and kings. You'll be arrested. Your family will turn on you. Your life will be under constant threat. These are the kinds of things that Jesus is preparing his disciples for. I'm sending you out into this. This is what you are going to face if you're following me. So he gathers the 12 in preparation for his mission and says, here's how it's going to play out. This is what the path is going to be like. If I was to give you directions to my home, I would tell you if you were coming from Belfast about the roundabout at White Abbey to turn left and follow up the road and White Abbey Hospital's on your left and you turn right along the Doak Road and you get to Monkstown, you turn right and talk about a set of traffic lights at Monkstown School and then on up beyond the Ulster Bank on the left-hand side in the Monkstown Road, you come to another set of traffic lights and you turn right and you go along the top road. If you reach the garage, you've gone too far. And I give you all the kind of details that you need to know so that you have markers along the way to say, oh yeah, he said that the bank would be there, and he said the traffic lights, and you know I'm on the right path here. I'm on the way home. I'm on the way to Michael's home because he told me this is what the journey would be like. And Jesus is putting down markers for his disciples to say, here's how you know you're headed home on the missionary journey. Here's how you know you're on the right path to my Father's house. Here are some markers or some signposts to look out for. He prepares his followers for the missionary journey home by saying, this is what it's going to be like, tough and unpleasant. Tough and unpleasant. And we think, Really? Really? Can I not have something more pleasant, more desirable than these difficult signposts along the way? It's true that it's terrifying, that this message that Jesus presents to his disciples is terrifying, uncomfortable, and unpleasant even to think about. But I want to suggest to you this morning that this is one of the most liberating messages that Jesus gives to his disciples, one of the most freeing pieces of information that Jesus shares with those he loves. Because you see, for you and I, as soon as trouble strikes my life, as soon as trouble strikes your life, we check our spiritual sat-nav and think, something must have gone wrong. I must have gotten off track because it's become really hard all of a sudden. Life has become unpleasant and difficult, and so we assume that we've gone off track with God. We go to our spiritual sat-nav and say, come on, can I get back on track? Surely it shouldn't be this difficult. And Jesus says, no, remember the conversation? Remember the conversation with my first disciples to say, here are the signposts that you're on the journey home. Here are the things to look out for. Hard times. Unpleasantness. Remember who you're following. Remember that you're following Jesus. Think about the path of his life. He's the master. You're the servant. Why should you expect to be treated any differently than he is? So Jesus constantly reminds his disciples and followers of what life is going to be like. I remember a teenager coming to me in Carrickfergus when I was a youth worker there, and he was really angry with God, really upset because his dad had gone to speak at a youth camp. And while his dad was away at a youth camp, his dad got sick. And David came to me and said, how is that even possible? I mean, my dad's over there doing God's work, and this happens to him. And you can understand his frustration, as I understood his frustration. And if we're honest with ourselves, we all have that attitude within us. We have the attitude of entitlement. Things should flow better for me because I have done this or this or this. And we wave our fist at God and get angry and expect better because in our lives, and in our eyes at least, our assessment of things is that we deserve better. Things should go better in our lives. We should be above trouble or immune to it or be able to navigate a pathway around it because, well, we're involved in the church and we serve God. And so we should look out for us. Is God not someone who cares for us and protects us? And so it's understandable that David, a teenager, comes to me with that question because who of us, if we're honest, wouldn't hold up our hands and say we've thought the same thing at times? Surely God could do a better job at looking after me. I mean, this has just arrived on my plate, or that has arrived on my plate, and it seems pretty unpleasant. Whether it's anger at a traffic jam or disappointment at a doctor's report, we've all looked at the situation before our eyes and thought, oh, seriously? This is what I have to deal with? This is what's going on right now? And we get frustrated at God's care of us. Have you ever done the right thing and gotten the wrong result? Have you ever, you know, been a loyal employee to your boss and defended him when other people were negative about him? And then being overlooked for a promotion? Or have you stood up for someone who was getting a hard time and found yourself excluded just like they were? And you thought, well, I did the right thing, but it doesn't seem to have worked out too well for me. And you wonder, where is God in the middle of this? Well, I want to suggest to you that if you feel like you've done the right thing and gotten the wrong result, then you're in good company. You're in the club of the Bible. Because the people of God, that is their story. Because Joseph, didn't he flee from sexual temptation? He fled from Potiphar's wife. Where did he end up? Jail. And Daniel, well, he was faithful to God in a foreign context where the rule and the laws were, do not pray to any other God, do not bow down to any other God. What did Daniel do? He did the right thing. He prayed faithfully to God. Where did he end up? In a lion's den. And Moses, well, he was called to go to Pharaoh to set the captives free and to release the Israelites from the slavery that they were experiencing. And he did the right thing. He honored God, and he ended up in the middle of the Red Sea with the walls either side of him, and they could come crashing down. You see, God doesn't take you out of trouble or promise that he will navigate you a way around trouble, but that he will take you through it. That he will be present with you in the middle of every situation that you're facing, and he will work his purposes out in that. So if you've done the right thing and gotten the wrong result, you're in good company. You're a follower of Jesus, the only man on earth who has always done the right thing. In him there is no sin, and look where his life took him, to a cross. That he suffered and died for doing the right thing and rose again victorious over it. There's a lot of talk today in the church about being the hands and feet of Jesus. And it's usually connected to mercy ministry, you know, kind of like helping hands that we do and cleaning up in a community, caring for those in need. And we rightly interpret that as the body of Christ, we get to fill the world and be the hands and feet of Jesus, feeling the sensitivities of the world outside, being conscious of what's going on out there, and bringing God's love and care to the people who need it most. And it's right and good that we should think about ourselves as being the hands and feet of Jesus, because it's a biblical picture of being the body of Christ. But I'm not sure that in the middle of all this talk about being the hands and feet of Jesus, we actually have in our minds what happened to the hands and feet of Jesus. That they were nailed to a cross. I'm not sure that we are expecting that or anticipating that when we're thinking about being the hands and feet of Jesus. A lot of the time we like the opportunity, and rightly so, to share God's love, to be compassionate and caring. But we need to consider the prospect and consider that Jesus prepares us for suffering by saying, if you are my hands and feet, if you are my body on earth, then don't expect to be treated any differently than my body was when I was here as a human being. Jesus prepares his disciples for persecution. He gets them ready for the journey home and says, here are some markers to look out for along the way. Difficulty in your family, opposition from the religious sphere. That's what you should expect. Expect persecution. One of his own disciples betrayed him with a kiss. You should expect the people closest to you to hurt you the most. That's what Jesus is preparing his disciples for. So if that's your experience this morning, God has not abandoned you. God is being faithful in the middle of that. He said it would be like this. He said you would face these situations. God is saying, I'm at work in that. I haven't just left my hands off it and thought, oh, that situation is far too messy for me to get involved, and I have no idea how to figure it out. And just like the first disciples may have looked at the cross and thought, how on earth could God be at work in that? How on earth could the purposes of God unfold in the middle of that? You and I can look at the difficult situations that we're experiencing that are in our faces right now and choose to believe, because God said it is so, that he is at work. That he has prepared us for the journey home, and saying, I told you it would be like this. You and I need to surrender to Jesus. We need to surrender to his interpretation of our events, to say, you told me it will be this way, so I will trust in you. I will trust in you. One of the most well-known pastors in America, leads one of the largest churches in the world, is this guy, Joel Osteen. And he's got quite white teeth and a big bright smile. And he's written a book called Your Best Life Now. It's a New York Times bestseller, not just among Christian people, not just among the church, but, you know, among people who are outside of the walls of the church. And who doesn't want their best life now? And so in here, there's 7 steps to living life at your full potential. And as I read the message of Jesus to his disciples, I'm not sure he is promising them their best life now. Jesus is not saying to his followers then or now, you can have your best life now. He's saying you're on the journey home and it's going to be hard. The only way this is your best life now, listen to me. The only way this is your best life now is if you never experience heaven. That's the only way that this will be the best. The best is yet to come. And so we can have hope in the middle of our difficulties. Hope in the middle of the journey, because Jesus said, here's a marker to know. Here's how you know you're headed home. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult. I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. It's a daunting prospect. But that's the preparation that Jesus gives to his disciples, prepares them to be sent people. This is what you should expect. Do not be surprised. Do not think that God has abandoned you. I am faithful in this. Jesus doesn't just prepare them for persecution. He also promises pastoral care. He doesn't just say, it's going to be tough, good luck. He shares how he will be with them and care for them and look after them in the middle of these difficulties. Amanda Gaisinger works for Nickelodeon in New York, and she's an Emmy award-winning illustrator. She's done really well, and she was interviewed recently about her life, and she's been on a bit of a journey with God. And it's interesting, even in her art and in her illustrations, how she reveals this change in her understanding of who God is and how he has been at work in her life. Her illustrations reflect this journey. And she said in the course of this interview, my distaste for this God I wasn't sure existed was pretty evident in those early wanderings. He showed up on the scene as a sullen, angry-looking cloud who perpetually glared out of his furrowed brow with a frown, although I did give him the benefit of a sense of humor occasionally. Here's one of Amanda's first illustrations as she began to think about her relationship with God. She just saw God as some angry cloud organizing stuff, but people didn't really like how it was working out. Here's her summary of the book of Job. That's her view of God. And maybe this morning you can connect with that. I love the honesty of that. I love the honesty of, like, this is where she is with God. She's saying, things are terrible, and you complain about it, and God's just saying, shut up and get on with it. Maybe that's your feelings right now. Maybe that's how you feel that God's attitude or heart is towards you right now. But she wrestled with her view of God. He wrestled with her and would not let her arrive at that conclusion as to who he was. He would not let her settle for this view of himself. And as her relationship with God changed and transformed, as she was changed and transformed by God, she started to paint and illustrate pictures that showed her renewed understanding of who he was. And so she takes this verse from Hebrews and says, we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness. And she starts to understand that actually God is familiar with all my ways. God knows me. I'm not thinking of a God who is immune to suffering. I am not dialoguing or having a conversation with a God who is remote and removed from difficulty, because he went to a cross. He is familiar with all your ways. The God that we worship is familiar with suffering. And so Amanda began to illustrate this. And here's another picture as she meditated on Psalm 139. She began to discover that God was with her always. And through a counseling session, she was encouraged to read Psalm 139, to repeatedly read Psalm 139. I encourage you to do that. Because one of the biggest lies the devil will tell you is you're forgotten. God's forgotten you. You're nobody. God's not interested in you. You read Psalm 139, you will begin to discover that God is with you always. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? The psalmist asks. If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, you're there. Even the darkness is as daytime to you. See, you cannot hide from God. He is familiar with all your ways. You're not forgotten. And so shortly after Amanda became a Christian, Nickelodeon exited the print industry and her entire department was laid off. She comments on this experience by saying, "Losing my dream job shortly after I became a Christian was a hard and fast lesson about attaching my hopes to my career instead of Christ." She come to a view in realizing that God was the one that she should place her hope in. Everything else could be stripped away. Everything else could be taken. But He is faithful. His word endures. He endures. His love remains. When all else fades, you remain. You can rely on Him. You can place your hope in Him. No matter what else is being stripped away from your life right now, that if your identity is located in Him, your identity is secure. Tim Keller says this, "When God seems to be killing us, He's actually saving us." Isn't that the story for Joseph? Isn't that the story for Jonah? Isn't that the story for Daniel? Isn't that the story for the people of God when they think, I'm going to die, but actually God is rescuing them? So as Moses walks through the Red Sea and the walls of water are either side, he's thinking, "You're killing me." When Daniel steps into a lion's den, "You're killing me." When Jesus goes to the cross, "You're killing me." But God is faithful. And Jesus is raised to life, victorious over death. And we locate our lives in Him. We have hope that death cannot even crush. And so no darkness can extinguish the light of His life. Are you in Christ this morning? Do you have a hope that cannot be snuffed out? So Jesus prepares His followers for persecution, and He promises them pastoral care. He promises that He will look after them. He promises that not even, you know, you are known intimately. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? You know, one coin had to buy two of them. They were so valueless. And Jesus is saying there, not even one of them falls to the ground. Are you not worth more than many sparrows in the eyes of God? Of course you are. Even the very hairs of your head are numbered. Jesus here in front of the disciples is flexing His muscles to say, "Who else has this kind of knowledge of you? What other relationship that you're trusting in right now can say this about your life? Even the very hairs of your head are numbered." What Jesus is saying to the disciples is, "I know you better than you know yourself. You don't even know the numbers of the hairs of your head. You don't even know the intricacies of your life like I do." But this attacks our pride because we like to think that we know best. We know the money in and out of the bank account. We know best how to discipline our children. I can't believe that he said I should have. Here's what you need to do. And you think, actually, here's what I need to do. Not listen to whatever you're going to say right now because my pride has just risen in my heart. I'm not telling you how to do your job. We know there's a but coming, right? We know there's a but coming. I'm not telling you how to do your job, but, and you think, well, I'm not listening to that. Because our pride says, actually, I know best. And Jesus says, I know best. I know you better than you know yourself. Even the very hairs of your head are numbered. Nobody can compete with that. No one is like our God. You need to surrender to Jesus. His knowledge of you is unbelievable. He knows best. You need to trust Him. And so He's encouraging His disciples to surrender to Him, to acknowledge Him in all their ways, to go as sent people, to witness to His greatness, to witness to His victory over death, not to be squeezed into the mold of the world, not to care too much about the opinions of other people, but to surrender completely to Jesus' knowledge of them and their circumstances. So let me ask you, is the path you're walking on right now a difficult one? Because if it is, God has not abandoned you. God is at work in that. Jesus said, These are the markers for the way home. These are the signposts to let you know that you are headed home. You need to surrender to Jesus. So in the garden, Jesus not only preaches that we should surrender to God's ways, that we should submit ourselves to Him, but He lives it out. He says, not my will, but yours be done. Jesus doesn't tell the disciples to do one thing and then do another. He lives it out in the face of the cross as He contemplates the enormity of being separated from His Father and crucified on a Roman cross. He says, yet not my will, but yours be done. He knows that God will take care of him. He trusts that God will look after him, even through the cross. So we can trust in Him. God cares best. God knows best. You need to surrender to Jesus. You need to come before Him and say, God, I'm sorry that I think that I know best. I'm sorry that I think that I know best how to run my life, how to look after my kids, how to do my job, how to interact with my friends. I need to acknowledge you in everything. I need to submit myself to your purposes and plans. I need to not do my own will, but do your will, to come under the authority of your word, to humbly come before you and say, lead me, Lord God. Help me to follow you. See, Jesus proves the reliability of God in the most horrific of circumstances. He proves that God is faithful even through the cross. And so what you're going through right now, you need to view it in light of the cross and say, I'm not sure how, but this I do know. You are at work in this. This situation is not beyond your grasp, because the cross assures me that this is how you save. When God seems to be killing us, He's actually saving us, and that fills us with hope. That in the most horrific and painful of situations, God is at work, saving us, rescuing us, leading us home. This is not your best life now. That awaits. One day we will get to be present fully face to face with God, where there will be no more tears or mourning or pain. The old order of things will pass away, but on the way home, we will face pain and difficulty right the way there. Jesus prepares His disciples for persecution, and He promises to be with them, promises to care for them and to look out for them. See, God did His best work. God did His best work while men did their worst. Do you believe that about your life this morning? While the worst of whatever is going on around you, while the most difficult of experiences happening around you, God is doing His best work.